Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 104 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. We got some good feedback on episode 103 with Professor Peter Duisberg of UC Berkeley. Rick on Facebook wrote, "Professor Duisberg has tried to keep the discussion honest and informed from the onset, and without losing his sense of humor." John, also on Facebook, wrote, "David, a good interview with Peter Duisberg. I was hoping to hear more on his position concerning the isolation and purification and existence of HIV. Why does Peter say it exists?" William on Facebook wrote, "His book, Inventing the AIDS Virus, 1996, set me on a correct path. I haven't been sick or taken any medications for the 20 years that I've been positive, and unlike my counterpart, long-term survivors who are complaining now about what those drugs did to them, I have remained healthier than most friends who are negative." Another David via email wrote, "I really enjoyed your interview of Professor Duisberg." Now let's go to our guest to talk about people who have been exonerated for a crime, often after spending many years in jail. Maurice Posley is a journalist who won a Pulitzer Prize in 2008. He's also a New York Times bestselling author who's written about, investigated, and consulted on issues involving criminal justice in the U.S. and abroad for more than 30 years. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan cited the Chicago Tribune's reporting, which included Maurice, as playing a key role in his historic decision to institute a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois in 2000, and also cited them in 2003 when he commuted the death sentences of 167 death row inmates to life in prison. In January 2011, the Illinois State Legislature voted to repeal the death penalty. Maurice is the author of three nonfiction books: Everybody Pays, Two Men, One Murder, and The Price of Truth, The Brown's Chicken Massacre, and the New York Times bestseller Hitler in the Crosshairs, A GI Story of Courage and Faith. Since the 1980s, Maurice has taught classes at the college and graduate school level on investigative reporting and criminal justice-related issues at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, the University of Montana, the University of Alaska, and the University of Michigan School of Law. From 2009 to 2012, he was an investigator for the Northern California Innocence Project at the University of Santa Clara's School of Law, where he wrote Preventable Error, Prosecutorial Misconduct in California, 1997 to 2009. Today, Maurice Posley is the senior researcher for the National Registry of Exonerations and also writes for the Marshall Project. Welcome to the show, Maurice.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So today I want to mainly talk about exonerations, but there's a lot of other issues that are entangled with it. I know that sometimes people are offered a new trial and the prosecution decides to proceed. Other times people are given time served or let out without being found fully innocent. Other times I believe people are declared innocent, and sometimes people are compensated, sometimes a little, sometimes a lot, and sometimes nothing. So what's sort of the spectrum of exonerations that at least lets somebody out of jail?
Well, when you use the word exoneration, different people use it in different ways. And for the purposes of the National Registry of Exonerations, we define it this way. Someone is convicted, and the consequences of that conviction are removed. Either it's reversed and dismissed, or it's reversed and they are acquitted at a retrial. Plus, there needs to be some evidence favorable to the defendant that was not presented at the trial resulted in their conviction that becomes available later. And examples of this can be person can recant after the trial. That's new evidence. A person can be an alibi witness that the defense failed to pursue.
Okay.
At the first trial. It could be evidence that was concealed by the prosecution that was not disclosed until later. It could be an expert witness that the defense failed to get or that the judge refused to allow in that an appellate court said that evidence should have been allowed in.
Right.
And so that's, you know, sort of a mouthful, but that's how they're defined. And so everyone who's in the registry, and as of today, it's getting close to 1,800 since 1989, is someone who was, as we define it, wrongfully convicted, some for crimes that other people committed, some for things that weren't a crime at all.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, whether there are people who've been convicted of crimes that never actually happened. Or maybe things that happened but weren't really a crime.
Well, a few examples of what we mean by what we call no-crime cases.
Mm-hmm.
Someone is convicted of an arson and setting a fire intentionally, and based on fire investigators' study of the evidence and the, you know, the debris and subsequently, what we now know is that over the last 25 years, there have been substantial advances in fire science that have debunked old theories of what certain evidence showed. Evidence that fire investigators say was were proof positive that an arson occurred have been shown to occur in accidental circumstances as well, and so they're really not proof at all.
I guess that's a whole, I could do a whole show, maybe I should, on forensic evidence that seems really certain, that seems as certain as a fingerprint, although I understand those aren't quite as certain as we think, that later is determined to be junk science, essentially. So that,
you definitely could. I mean, one of the junk science has been a lot in the headlines or in the news a lot lately is bite marks.
Right.
And that's really been debunked, discredited as junk. One that's a little bit more subtle is what has been known for years as shaken baby.
Yes, I've actually done a show on shaken baby syndrome, so I'm pretty. There are still people who defend that. They've renamed it as
abusive trauma.
But there are a lot of people who believe that if there's no external signs of abuse, that it's caused by internal bleeding and may have some medical cause that has nothing to do with abuse. I've also heard problems with hair analysis and shoe print analysis as well. So I guess it's a big field. What are the statistics on exonerations? How is the trend going over time?
Well, it's sort of a mushy area to talk about. We record the exonerations that we find out about.
Mm-hmm.
We don't profess to be able to say definitively how many are actually occurring out there. What we do know, and that's because, you know, we have 50 states in this country, and we have nearly 3,000 counties, and each one is an individual jurisdiction. And that's just in the state system, not counting the federal system. And so, nobody keeps track of it.
Right.
And so we try to do the best we can. We think we've gotten better at it. Certainly what we report is that more people are being exonerated each year in the last few years. In 2015, the total now is 150.
150 just for 2015?
153 for just 2015.
And how do you know how many people have been exonerated while on death row?
Well, the figure, I mean, I can pull it up in a second, but the Death Penalty Information Center is a website that tracks that specifically. Now, they have a little bit different criteria than we do, but it's more than it's up to 150 or so off death row.
I personally think that's one of the biggest arguments against the death penalty. Is it's pretty tough when somebody's spent 30 years in jail and gets released. You know, it's not like you're going to get those 30 years back. But on the other hand, if you execute somebody and later find out that they're innocent, well, there's nothing you can do to...
You can't get out the paddles, no.
Yes. Which is really terrible. When people are exonerated, are they immune? Well, let me give you an example. Recently, the New York Times reported on a judge who refused to send a drug trafficker to jail, just gave her parole because he said that the sanctions against ex-felons were so harsh that this was punishment enough, such as not getting support for tuition and things like that. So if you're exonerated, are you immune from those things, or will you still find it difficult to get public housing, food stamps, all the other privileges that the average American citizen might have access to?
I think you can make an argument that people who are exonerated are on even shakier ground than someone who is rightfully convicted and released. There are certain services when you're released on parole that you're entitled to. When you're exonerated, they basically give you whatever you have in your cell that's yours, that you want to take with you. If you have any money in your sort of commissary account, and they say, have a nice life.
Right. So here's $50, a bus ticket, and a change of clothes. And
right. And it's sort of up to you to figure out how do you go about getting a driver's license? How do you go about registering to vote? How do I get health insurance?
Right.
These are things that a lot of us take for granted. They're driven a car. They went in as teenagers and they're coming out as adults. They have never, you know, lived most of their life in custody. There's a fellow in Illinois who was exonerated named Daniel Taylor, and for quite a while after his release, he had trouble walking through doorways because he was not used to walking through an open door without getting permission from someone, namely. So, you know, this is a kid who was arrested at age 17 for a crime that he didn't commit. He got sentenced to life without parole, which means they want you to die there.
Right.
A different kind of death penalty. And he came out more than 20 years later, 40-something year old man.
Yeah, with no experience of even the simple things in life, like, as you say, just going through a door, let alone the computer revolution, smartphones, all those other things that people take for granted. There's a lot to learn with no support. If you're in jail on death row, you, I believe, get access to a state-funded attorney. But if you believe that you're innocent and you're not on death row, do you get any support in jail?
Well, it sort of depends on where the status of your case. I mean, if you have a pending case, you're indigent, get an attorney appointed.
Right. But let's say you've been convicted, but you believe you're innocent.
Well, let's say you're innocent, you're convicted and your appeals are over.
Right.
What do you do? You can continue to file pro se, meaning on your own, without petitions, hoping that a court will pay attention to it. It's sort of tough to develop evidence when you're locked up. You have to have somebody, some support people out there at some point. I don't know. Extremely difficult. Once you're convicted, sort of the everything changes. It becomes exponentially more difficult to fight your case because the presumption that the jury or the judge got it right.
Yes.
And arguing actual innocence is a difficult path. I can't say that there's typical, but in a lot of cases what you see is that someone is able to get in front of a judge on the basis that their defense attorney failed to do certain things, failed to provide adequate defense, and that then becomes the vehicle for uncovering new evidence that can be presented to a court. There becomes once you get convicted, you have to really have be able to fight the law, that there were mistakes made in the law.
And doesn't it also cause you problems, like if you are, say, eligible for parole and you proclaim your innocence, that's interpreted as you're not admitting that you did it, and you're not dealing with your guilt. So,
well, certainly that's when you go up for parole, and one of the things that the parole boards always want to hear is, you know, do you have remorse? Have you, you know,
right,
what you've done? And what you see in some cases, particularly sexual assault cases, are people who say, I'm not admitting to this because I didn't do it. And
right.
So they denied parole, and they stay in a lot longer, and they actually max out when they could have been released a lot earlier, but they don't want to because they believe in, you know, evidence of only has shown it in some of these cases that they were in fact innocent.
Right. I mean, I think people differ. There are some people who are kind of strategic, and they'll agree to pretty much anything if they think there's a benefit, which I guess is why a lot of people plead guilty for crimes they didn't commit. But other people are going to say, no, I didn't do it, so I'm never going to admit it, even though that's going to cost me possibly years extra in jail.
Right.
What are the major reasons that people are found guilty for a crime they didn't commit? I think pleading guilty in a plea deal is one. False confessions, there's false witness testimony. But in your analysis, what are the biggest reasons?
Well, let's just take a step back and say, we talked about arson, we talked about shaken baby.
Right.
The primary no-crime case, there's two. One is a sort of a more recent phenomenon, is someone who makes a false allegation that they were sexually assaulted. That is probably the leading no-crime case. And it's either proven by DNA testing or a recantation that shows that, in fact, no crime actually occurred. It was a false accusation.
Mm-hmm.
We categorize six what we call contributing factors that contributed to the wrongful conviction. And so obviously, some cases can have more than one. The most common cause contributing factor is perjury or false accusation. Someone who just deliberately lies to accuse someone of a crime.
Right.
Second is official misconduct, which would be police misconduct, prosecutor misconduct. We have particularly in one county in Texas, Harris County, which is Houston.
Mm-hmm.
We have more than 100 cases, and eventually it'll be a couple or maybe even 300 where people were arrested and police seized what they believe were controlled substances. People offered plea deals. They pled days, and subsequently the labs tested the material, and it turned out to be negative for any kind of controlled substance.
So they arrested on drug for a drug crime. They tested the drugs, and they found that there were no drugs, but they'd already pled guilty in
Correct.
Some cases?
Correct. So we've added more than 100 cases to the registry out of Harris County alone, and where this has happened. And there's a lot more that are going to that are basically in the pipeline in the system.
Because you couldn't, I presume, maybe my ignorance shows here, but I presume you couldn't actually convict somebody of drug possession if you didn't prove they had drugs, but you can get a plea deal prior to the testing. You could say, we know this was heroin, so don't lie to us, and we'll give you this deal, and nobody's actually tested it yet. Is that the kind of situation?
Right. I mean, some of these people probably thought they did have drugs, but it turned out not to be.
Right.
But a lot of it is people who are stopped with pills, okay, that the cops think are controlled substance pills.
Right.
They don't have a prescription, and it turns out to be over-the-counter medication. It's not controlled. It's not a crime to have, and anybody can have them. It's just low-grade sedatives or that sort of thing, painkillers.
Right.
But they get arrested, and typically these are people who have been arrested in the past.
Right.
So PETA offender laws are tough.
Right.
So you're offered, you know, sort of the deal of the day, and so you take it.
Yeah, I can see people doing that. How long can it take to get stuff tested and to actually have a trial? Like, if you say you're not going to take the deal, how long can you wait in jail around for this to happen?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, it depends sort of on the jurisdiction. It depends sort of in places like Louisiana, which is having kind of a crisis right now, where people are being held for long periods of time and they can't get any, even get in, number one, can't even get a lawyer
mm-hmm.
in court. They wind up pleading guilty because they just want to get on with their lives. It can be a year, it can be 6 months. I mean, it sort of depends on, is there a backlog in the crime lab?
Right.
Some of these cases, people are sort of amazed that they went ahead and tested it even after the person pled guilty. Sort of like, well, why spend the time if the person admitted the guilt? But it turns out that what they've, in doing so, they find that there's a lot of mistakes being made. Either bad field tests, or bad assumptions that are being made by police officers in terms of recognition of what they're, you know, what they're seizing from people or finding from people.
Yeah, and mentioning Harris County, is this related? I believe Harris County has a conviction integrity unit. Is this related to that, or is this just the lab that continues to test even if?
Well, they have a conviction integrity unit, and in fact, the unit was basically set up in part to deal with this issue. And so all the cases are being funneled through their conviction integrity unit, where apparently what was going on was that the labs were routinely testing everything.
Right.
Once they tested, they'd send a copy of the report to the district attorney's office. And it was somehow just winding up, you know, literally, at least figuratively, in a box, and no one was paying any attention to them.
Which would be prosecutorial misconduct, right? Like, doesn't a prosecutor have a responsibility that if they receive evidence that a conviction was not true, that they need to bring that forward?
Well, that's what they're doing now.
I mean, mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem it was just benign neglect. That these things were coming in and no one was paying any attention to them if it was not a case that someone had that was pending.
Right.
And since they'd all been resolved, they just kind of sat there, was nobody's case. The case was over. And so nobody was, this is sort of my take on it, no one was paying any attention to it until finally somebody did and said, well, wait a minute. As far as I can tell, there's about 400 cases.
No controlled substance found cases.
Well, I would say the vast majority are, maybe 80-85%. There's a small percentage where it's a lesser amount or it's a different drug.
Right, like a different drug. It's still a controlled substance, but not the one they were charged with, or?
Right. Different. And so you can't plead guilty to possession of cocaine when it's meth, okay?
That's
a bad example, but...
Yeah.
Or if you plead guilty to a felony level of crack, and it turns out to be, a very minute amount that's actually a misdemeanor amount.
Right.
You're allowed to vacate your plea.
Okay. Now, in your reports, you've criticized some of these conviction integrity units as mere window dressing. Some, like Harris County, have overturned a lot of convictions, but others you've documented have not really done much. I mean, do you think they were just set up to say that we're dealing with a problem and actually just not do anything?
Well, you can't tell until you get some time out and see
mm-hmm.
what do they actually do, and how are they handling cases that come before them. Are they becoming units that basically try to prevent convictions from being overturned, or are they being very open?
Right. And in a very conservative... go ahead.
Look at Ken Thompson in New York and Brooklyn, where I think they're up to 20 or 21 cases that they've vacated convictions on. And then you have the unit in Chicago, where the outgoing state's attorney, she did not win the primary, and so she's going to be out. Critics have said that, she's more in the business of preserving convictions. So it's sort of, you have to, over time, figure out, are they window dressing?
Right.
Or are they being serious about this? And, I hate to use a well-worn cliche, but, the proof will be in the pudding on a lot of these cases. Now, I saw an article this morning, this week, about Clark County in Nevada, Las Vegas, has got funding to create a conviction integrity unit. And the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, which deals with wrongful convictions out in several states out there.
Right.
Already criticizing it as being, a political maneuver, and that it's their heart's really not in it. Well, it's hard to tell.
Right.
They haven't even hired the people yet. Maybe that will be an accurate prediction, and maybe it won't.
Well, and sometimes people... surprise you. I mean, sometimes people who are put into a job who are basically given a hint that, we really don't want you to do your job, sometimes those people actually try to do their job. it's even if you set up a system like that, it doesn't necessarily accomplish what you want. In some of these places, like Texas, it's a very conservative area, that you wouldn't expect Texans to be saying, gee, we need to let people out of jail. You kind of think that the feeling down there would be we need more people in jail for longer. So what were the political pressures that led to the conviction integrity unit being set up?
In Texas?
Yeah. You wouldn't think of the average Texan saying we need to overturn convictions. I mean, was it a tough sell, and who was behind it?
Sort of I call it the godfather, but the first one was really in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
where the district attorney, Craig Watkins became district attorney, was elected in 2007, and he was the first black man to be elected DA Texas, let alone Dallas.
Right.
And one of the things that he did almost immediately was to set up a unit that was designed to, we're going to take any requests to do DNA testing. We're not going to oppose this stuff. And a lot of people got exonerated.
Oh, I see. So in that case, it was the district attorney basically alone saying, this is part of my job, is to make sure that we didn't put people in jail when they weren't guilty.
Exactly.
It wasn't like there was an outcry from the local population.
And it sort of served as the, it wasn't the very first one that was ever established, but it certainly was the highest profile and the one that had an enormous amount of success. And it sort of became the model for others. And Ken Thompson got elected in Brooklyn. His predecessor, Charles Hines, had a conviction integrity unit. But just talking about it, critics said it didn't do a whole lot.
Right.
Except fight people who who said that they were innocent. And so Thompson he created a unit. He reshaped it. It has an outside advisory committee of people who review cases. He really gave it a lot of independence, gave it its own budget, and basically said, I don't care truth. I don't care what happens as long as we get the truth.
In North Carolina, they have what's called an Innocence Inquiry Commission, which I believe is unique in the United States. How does that differ from these conviction integrity units?
Well, the North Carolina commission is made up of people, including judges, defense lawyers, prosecutors, and people submit cases to them for their review.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fairly time-consuming but quite an in-depth process. And anyone in the state can come, no matter what county, whereas conviction integrity unit like Craig Watkins in Dallas was only for Dallas County cases.
Okay, I understand.
Cases. This is covers the entire state, and it's got some critics as being very slow-moving. There's no question that they've exonerated some people.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a perfect model? I don't know. Ken Thompson's is a pretty good model.
Right.
But in a state like North Carolina, where you have a lot of counties that couldn't afford to have a conviction integrity unit.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the situation in a lot of counties in this country, that they're rural, they have a low budget, they're not necessarily going to be able to afford to have people set aside whose job it is solely to reinvestigate old cases. That serves a distinct purpose in North Carolina.
And is a conviction integrity unit always managed by the district attorney, always part of their office?
Well, that's how they've sort of evolved. Ultimately, the district attorney is the one that decides. Our review shows that we think the conviction is good, or our review shows that we think the conviction is bad and it should not stand, and we will voluntarily go in and move to vacate this conviction.
Right, and if the district attorney is part of the problem, then they're either not going to set one up or they're going to make sure it doesn't accomplish too much.
Or they will do the right thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It just sort of depends. Ultimately, the integrity of the office is at stake. And if my lawyer walks my case into Ken Thompson's office, okay? And Ken Thompson says, okay, we're going to reinvestigate this case. And 6 months or 9 months later, they say, we conclude that this conviction is a good conviction. I still may be able to file a motion in court or file a petition in court and seek redress there.
Right.
And a prosecutor who says the conviction is good does risk a judge at some point saying you were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So the question sort of, it comes down to, you know, pay me now, pay me later, or where does the sort of the integrity of your office stand on this? So every case is different.
Right.
And, you know, you have cases where, you know, they wind up out of the state system into the federal system with a federal writ of habeas corpus that winds up being granted.
So, I mean, a conviction integrity unit might bring forward some new evidence and then look at it and say, well, this really doesn't amount to too much. But the person in jail and their supporters might look at it differently and say, no, we think we could win this.
Sure.
And if too much of that happens, then it kind of makes it look like the CIU is not doing its job.
Or that the job they're doing is biased.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there'll always be gray areas.
People can differ.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cases where the evidence is, is not very cut and dried. Going back to the reasons for prosecutorial or official misconduct, I guess not just prosecutors but also police, what are the reasons why police and prosecutors would want to put somebody in jail, or in some cases is it just laziness that they don't want to, you know, they've got somebody and they don't want to go looking for the actual person who did it?
Well, I don't think that by and large prosecutors walk into court and say, today I'm going to convict an innocent man.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they are presented with cases, believe they have the right person. And accordingly, based on that, what happens is that patient procedure, and sometimes even when it gets into the prosecutor's office, they put the blinders on. And they see what they want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And they evidence that points to someone's innocence, to his exculpatory evidence, is viewed as red herrings or distractions, because to them it's not evidence of innocence, it's just it's something that doesn't fit within their theory. Putting the blinders on too early in a case, way early in a case, means that evidence is ignored, leads aren't followed, and evidence disappears that's favorable to a defendant. When I was a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, we wrote about a number of stories, one in particular where a 15-year-old kid he said he confessed to stabbing a woman to death.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a knife. They didn't have the clothes. They had a body. The problem was they got the confession before the autopsy, and the autopsy showed no stab wounds.
That's a bit of a problem.
That is a bit of a problem. And so, you know, but they took him to trial anyway. Ultimately, he was acquitted, but...
Well, that is kind of incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, in that case, I guess it doesn't matter for this guy, but, I mean, what did she die of, natural causes, or was it a bullet wound, or like...
Well, she was, it was blunt force trauma.
Oh, okay.
They had a dead person.
Right.
It appeared she'd been murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He got fingered by someone who I came to believe was the actual killer, who got arrested on a drug charge and gave up this kid, whom he knew, as a way of deflecting attention from himself. And they brought this 15-year-old kid in, and he'd been smoking weed that day, and a few hours later, got him to sign a confession that he stabbed her to death, and that he threw the knife in a dumpster behind his house, and along with his bloody clothes, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And none of it was true.
Right. I think much more is coming out about false confessions, but I still think that people have difficulty understanding why somebody, you know, facing potential life in prison or even the death penalty would confess to something they didn't do. Somewhere in the documents you had, you mentioned John Burge in Chicago, and this was a lot darker because he was actually torturing people to extract confessions, which obviously is not just laziness. This is actually an active attempt to get a false confession, and probably combined with some sadism. I mean, have you heard of similar situations in other cities where policemen are actually torturing people to get confessions?
Well, there have been individual allegations of abuse, physical abuse, in interrogation rooms, but the Chicago instance is probably the most dramatic over a period of time. More than a hundred defendants have claimed that they were physically abused in various forms of torture, including, you know, electrical shocks, plastic bags, you know, over their heads, near suffocation, guns in their mouths, being strapped to a hot radiator without clothes, naked, you know, that sort of thing. And along with just plain physical, you know, the punching and kicking.
Right, which is
additional stuff.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people still do have, we know a lot more about wrongful or false confessions now than we did 5 years ago. Still hard for people to get their arms around. They say, I would never do that.
Right. I mean, I guess it's maybe easier to see in a case of John Burge. I mean, if somebody has a plastic bag put over their head and then they confess, everybody can understand that. But it's maybe harder to put yourself into, you know, interrogation room for hours at a time when you're being fed maybe misinformation by the policeman until you see pleading guilty is the only way out of that room.
Well, it's not pleading guilty. It's falsely confessing.
Oh, confessing. Yeah, essentially pleading guilty. Yeah.
We did a series of articles about 15 years ago in Chicago about false and coerced confessions, and I remember interviewing this kid who said, well, eventually I just got tired of it, and I told them what they wanted to hear because I figured I'd go to court and tell the judge the truth and they'd let me go.
Mm.
Well, of course, that's not the way it works.
No.
You sign that paper or are said to have confessed, you're in pretty deep, and it's extremely difficult to extricate yourself from that. We have, I think, about 225 cases of false confession exonerations in the registry. And so these are all people who confessed, but it was false, and have been exonerated. There's also cases of people who are falsely implicated by others who say, well, I did it, but I did it with so-and-so. And truth is that person did it, but falsely implicating someone else.
Well, there's, I think, I can't remember this guy's name, but he was almost executed recently. He ran a motel, and one of his assistants was a bad drug addict who killed his boss, and the manager of the hotel got implicated by him and ended up with the death penalty. I think it was in Oklahoma. He's not being exonerated yet, but it seems like there's lots of evidence he's not guilty. I think it was Deborah Milkey. In that case, there was a claim of a confession, but she claims that she'd never confessed, and there was no recording of the confession. I mean, how can that happen where somebody says she confessed to me and goes to court and wins when the person is saying I didn't confess?
Well, that's one of the reasons that there's been a movement to get recording of interrogations across the country. I think Colorado just passed a bill, and it's going to the governor for signature, to require recording of interrogations in felonies. Not most states, a lot of states are turning to this. A lot of individual police departments have started to do it. You know, historically, it's been a swearing contest when you get to court. The police officers say one thing and the defendant says another. And guess who gets believed most of the time?
Yeah, that is, and in the case of Deborah Mielke, she got the death penalty before she was exonerated. Is that
right?
Correct? And I forget what the crime was supposedly in that case.
That was a murder.
Okay. Another case that you used as an illustration was two brothers, Floyd and Tom Bledsoe, and it appears that one of them did the crime but then implicated his brother, who ended up getting convicted. In that case, I didn't understand why the prosecutor would want to convict the brother who it was pretty clear didn't do it. Like, why not convict the guy who, it looked, the evidence was, had done it?
Well, I mean, there are some suggestions that the prosecutor was corrupt. That's a bizarre case. It just is a completely bizarre case. That came to our attention last year, I was just kind of astonished. And I remember talking to one of his lawyers at the Midwest Innocence Project saying, how did this guy get convicted on this? Well, he had a really bad lawyer who believed that he was innocent, or guilty,
right? Right.
You know, when you go back in hindsight being much more perfect vision and you look at
right.
what happened, the only thing you can conclude is that there had to be some influence on the district attorney and the defense lawyer by the father.
Oh, and the father somehow participated at least in disposing of the body or something?
Well, there were some strong indications. I think it was very circumstantial that suggested that the father may have been helped hide the body. you know, this was a brother, sexually assaults and kills this young girl who was the sister of the other brother's wife. So it was a familial thing.
Right.
Acts of sort of this backwoods cover-up kind of thing.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the more bizarre cases. I just couldn't understand why, but I guess if the father was favoring one brother over the other and maybe had a grudge against one of his sons, then I could see trying to push the scales to protect the son he liked and punish the one that he didn't like. And in some families, being the good guy is actually a bad thing. It's dysfunctional families. Do you look much at other countries? Like, I'm from Canada, and I know that there's been a lot of, also a lot of convictions overturned recently in Canada. But is this like a global problem?
Well, I think wherever you have organized systems of criminal justice, you're going to have mistakes being made. Sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not. As long as we have beings, that's what's going to happen, in my opinion. I know that there was, I actually had some conversation with some folks in Canada about setting up a similar exoneration registry in Canada to track these cases.
Mm-hmm.
Canada has, I think, has had a history of being much more forward-thinking in reviewing cases of wrongful conviction to find out what went wrong. particularly forensic problems that occurred, and this goes back, I'm dating myself, but there have been a couple of commissions that investigated cases and shown how things go wrong. And they were sort of, I'm trying to remember the first real commission, but it was sort of held up as an example in the United States. This is what we should be doing. You know, when a plane goes down, we try to figure out why it happened. When
right.
Someone comes out of surgery and they have removed the wrong limb, we try to figure out why that happened.
Right.
Go back and take a retrospective.
Yeah, I forget the first major overturning, but I think it was a case where there was a murder and they took the sort of prototypical, quote, drunk Indian, and they convicted him of it. And if I'm correct, it was when Canada still had the death penalty. I think it was eliminated in the 60s or 70s. And he was years in jail before being exonerated. And another inquiry was over the work of Charles Smith, who was a pediatric forensic pathologist, who sent a lot of people to jail on accusations of shaken baby syndrome and other forensic evidence. And they basically have agreed now that all his evidence was corrupt, and that he basically saw his job to convict people of killing babies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was many cases. I don't know, something like 50 cases or something, just from one pathologist.
Yeah, I think it was somebody named Gee something.
Yeah, I should have done some more research on that. But there is one lawyer in Canada who's been most active on this area, and I should maybe interview him as well. I'd like to ask...
E. Paul Morin.
Okay. I'm not sure that was the first one, but...
No, but that was the one that was definitely held up
as
a model in terms of an inquiry. And it was a lot of forensic fakes were made. And
Yeah, I guess we can learn from each other. And I guess from a good point of view, a legal system that is mature enough can look at its own flaws. It's pretty hard to think of, say, Saudi Arabia having a commission for false convictions, given the state of their justice system. I wanted to ask you if there was a tension between your work as a journalist and I think your work, with some of your work at least, could be described as activism. Like, have you felt this tension? Have you been criticized for not being, quote, an unbiased journalist in the work you've done?
You're always going to... In 1999, we published a series of articles on prosecutorial misconduct that caused a lot of prosecutors to react negatively.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact was, it was all based on actual cases. It was cases where judges had actually made findings that prosecutors engaged in misconduct. When myself and other reporters worked on individual cases, the district attorney in Chicago at one point came into our editorial office and said, you know, these guys don't write anything nice about us. And the editor said, well, that's not their job. They investigate these cases, and if they can back it up, we print it.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't. And we're going to get people who don't like it, but if they can't dispute the truth of it,
right.
If it's not like it, then, you know, too bad. We were always extraordinarily careful to document everything. And there were a few cases where we walked away from them because we didn't think that we had enough to write about.
Yeah.
You know, your credibility is at stake, and the last thing you want to do is publish an article that says this person is innocent and have someone come forward. They didn't talk to me, And I was there, you know, that's the sort of thing. So,
yeah, I can see that if you published 100 cases of prosecutorial misconduct and one was false, that would be the one that got focused on.
Right, exactly.
Finally, we're kind of running out of time, but if somebody knows somebody who they think has been falsely convicted, I mean, what are a couple of things that these people should start to do if they want to get out of the mess that they're in?
Well,
maybe that's too big of a question.
Well, no. I mean, we get people writing to us all the time, and mm-hmm. we don't do that. We don't investigate cases. We don't represent people in court.
Right.
We are a research project that studies causes and collects data for that we can then use to make policy statements or to influence policy legislators,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. And what we say is, here there's a website called the Innocence Network.
Okay.
And the Innocence Network has a list of all Innocence projects that belong to the network, and this includes people in outside of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
foreign countries. And we say, reach out to the project that is closest to the jurisdiction where you were convicted. Because these are geographical. And hope for the best. I mean, try to enlist, you know, if you can enlist a lawyer to. Sometimes people get a lawyer who's curious, you know, they can enlist through their curiosity and who will be willing to work on a case. There's a case that just got exonerated in California a couple of weeks ago that we're still in the process of writing up for the registry, where a man was convicted in 1987, and after his appeals, he had filed pro se on his own a petition, and a lawyer was appointed by a judge.
Mm-hmm.
In 1999. Well, it finally just happened. From 1999, and she's been working on that case ever since.
From 1999 to the present day before it resulted in an exoneration?
Correct.
Well, I mean, that's pretty close to a whole lifetime.
Yep.
Okay, well, I think people will probably get a lot of better understanding of this subject from listening to this interview, and I'm sure that will generate a lot of ideas about what to do about it if you know somebody in this unfortunate situation. So I would just like to thank you for joining me today, and I will send you a link to the podcast when it comes out in a few days.
Great. Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye, David.
Thank you for listening to episode 104 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.